Russia says calls for the inclusion of Iran's missile program and other new issues in the JCPOA revival talks are, quote, unrealistic and unproductive. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai says people in his country are paying a heavy price for the NATO and US military missions' failure to defeat terrorism. Also ahead, at least 150 people have been killed in more than 400 shootings across the US during the 4th of July holiday weekend. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Russia says Iran's nuclear issues and talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal should not be mixed up with issues surrounding the Persian Gulf security. Mikhail Odionov, Russia's lead negotiator, denounced calls for the inclusion of new issues such as regional security and Iran's missile program in the talks on the 2015 deal. He rejected those calls as unrealistic and counterproductive, saying they are an attempt to hit three birds with one stone. He noted that the negotiations must only focus on restoring the Iran nuclear deal in its original form agreed upon in 2015. Meanwhile, the leaders of France, Germany and China have called on all parties involved in the Vienna talks to seize a window of opportunity for an agreement. China says the unilateral US withdrawal from the deal and its maximum pressure campaign against Iran are the root causes of the current stalemate in the talks. Columnist and political scientist Wilmer Leon says the US effort to add additional issues to the JCPOA survival talks shows Washington does not intend to get back to the nuclear deal.
Why the United States continues to try to make very simple issues such as getting back into the JCPOA such a challenge, such a mystery, such an eight-day bicycle race, no one can really seem to figure out, other than the United States really doesn't want to do it.
Right.
If they want to add additional issues here, and if Iran's nuclear program is an issue, then Israel's nuclear program must be on the table.
Right.
And also, the United States just can't be trusted here. This all gets back, I think a big part of all of this conversation gets back to Tony Blinken and the United States' discussion about the rules-based order and whatever that means, other than the United States thinking that it's a unitary global hegemon and that it can make the rules up as it wants to and it can tell the world to do what it wants to do. So a lot of the United States position has no grounding in international law. It has no grounding in justice. It has no grounding in actually being rational.
The Taliban say they're planning to present a written peace proposal to the Afghan government as early as next month. A spokesman for the militant group said the peace talks with the government will be accelerated in the coming days. Sabihullah Mujahid added that the talks will take a month before the two sides reach a stage where they can exchange peace plans. A new round of talks began in the Qatari capital Doha last week. That coincided with the US handover of Bagram Air Base near Kabul to Afghan forces almost after two decades. The US has already announced the complete pullout of its forces from Afghanistan before September 11. However, former Afghan President Hamid Karzai has described the US-led NATO mission in his country as a failure.
In terms of the main US and allies' objective, in which the Afghan people also shared, joined hands, an end to extremism, stability in Afghanistan, peace in our country, no. It has been disastrous for us.
Karzai said the Afghan people are now paying a heavy price for the failure of foreign forces in the country. He urged the government and the Taliban to sit down for talks at the earliest to secure a lasting peace. His call comes as the militant group has continued expanding its hold over territories across Afghanistan. Local groups in some provinces are joining forces to put up an armed resistance against the Taliban.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by U.S. President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Turning elsewhere, the Independence Day weekend in the United States has been marred by gun violence, leaving at least 150 people dead in more than 400 shootings across the country. 26 people were killed in New York alone, as the city has witnessed almost 40% spike in gun violence since last year. At least 90 people were shot in Chicago, 14 of them fatally. The police had already raised concern, calling this year's Independence Weekend most challenging. It was also a violent holiday in Dallas, as police there investigate at least two major incidents. Last month, the U.S. Homeland Security report warned about a rise in mass shootings. It said the 4th of July celebrations and other anniversaries are typically associated with high-profile racially or ethnically driven attacks in the U.S. Lebanon's Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah describes resistance media as partners in all victories achieved so far against the oppressors. He also praises the media for breaking the U.S. hegemony in the region. Mariam Saleh has more in this report from Beirut.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Sayed Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayed Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayyid Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Now, Iraqi security officials say a drone has been intercepted and shot down by American forces over an area close to the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. The officials said the drone was downed before reaching the embassy compound. Videos posted on social media showed American defense systems firing rockets into the air in Baghdad. The incident comes hours after the U.S.-led military coalition said at least three rockets targeted the Ain al-Assad airbase hosting American forces in western Iraq. It said the attack left no injuries but caused material damage to the base. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for that attack. U.S. bases and their supply convoys in Iraq have come under increasing attacks amid growing anti-American sentiment in the Arab country. Yemen's ambassador to Tehran tells Press TV that Saudis and their allies waged a war on his country to impose their will on the Yemenis, but they failed thanks to the Yemenis' resistance.
The aggression against Yemen, we said from the first day, is a Saudi-U.S. aggression. This began in the capital of the United States in Washington at the time of President Obama. They only wanted to enforce their hegemony, their political hegemony, on the Yemeni people. They could not enforce this hegemony. They could not change the government in Yemen. Army was able to face an international war against it and show that the many armies that were very strong and superior were Yemeni army with the people of Yemen, and the fighters were able to face this issue here. We're on the seventh year of this aggression, and the Yemeni people with God's faith. And
the Islami stressed that the UN-mediated talks in Yemen will fail, as they wrongly label an act of foreign aggression as an internal conflict. The ambassador said the United Nations needs to address the U.S.-backed Saudi blockade on Yemen and a withdrawal of all foreign forces to set the stage for inter-Yemeni talks. He noted that the Saudis gained nothing out of their offensive except for inflicting a humanitarian crisis on the country.
If we were talking about killing the Yemenis, about tens of thousands, or destroying the infrastructure of Yemen, they succeeded in that. There are also many people who are in famine, and there's so much hunger and famine in the country. This is what Saudi Arabia succeeded in very strongly. But anything else,
the ambassador said Riyadh and its allies have also been in contact with Daesh and Al-Qaeda, terrorist groups in the central province of Marib, which Ansar Allah forces have been trying to liberate. He said four districts in the province have been freed, and the Yemeni forces will continue their push to fully liberate the region. Deilami also hailed Iran's support for Yemeni's resistance forces. He said Iran is the only country that has been standing by Yemeni people and pushing for an end to the war while leaving the fate of the country to its people. Now, a wide divide between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates over oil output has deepened the crisis in the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. The rare standoff between the two longtime allies started over Riyadh's insistence that OPEC should increase production over the next few months and extend output cuts to the end of 2022. The UAE argued against the proposal and said monthly output cuts should be eased by 400,000 barrels a day from August. OPEC sources say the ministerial panel chaired by Saudi Arabia and Russia needed more time to resolve the issue. The impasse leaves the global economy guessing how much oil it will get next month, with international crude futures contracts rising to their highest levels since October 2018. Energy market expert Iman Nasri says Saudi Arabia wants to defend the current oil prices despite having lost a significant portion of its market share.
Yes, actually, Saudi's suggestion and proposal to extend the agreement, which expires next year in April 2022, to the end of the year, is to defend prices. And Saudi has the new oil minister of Saudi Arabia has proved to be basically in favor of defending prices rather than market share. Well, actually, Saudi is the largest exporter, so the export volumes, despite having cut down from a high 9 million barrels at some point or more down to 6 or 7 million barrels per day, but still it's a significant number. However, other members of OPEC, including the United Arab Emirates, whose production have been cut in percentage-wise more than Saudi, and their exports actually have hit significantly,
right,
are not in favor of that and more in favor of defending market share.
French prosecutors say they are investigating claims that a Saudi prince kept seven women in a state of modern slavery. The women, most of them from the Philippines, were recruited in Saudi Arabia and worked for the prince and his family in a posh neighborhood in Paris. The prosecutors have also opened human trafficking charges into the case against Prince Faisal bin Turki bin Abdullah Al Saud. French media reported that the women barely had time to eat and were found while crying with hunger. The women filed complaints of modern-day slavery in October 2019. Wraps up our bulletin for this hour.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The record-shattering heat wave currently scorching the Pacific Northwest has been linked to hundreds of deaths in the region, with British Columbia alone reporting at least 486 sudden and unexpected fatalities. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, Horrifying, Record-Breaking Northwest Heat Wave Linked to Hundreds of Deaths. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The record-shattering heat wave currently scorching the Pacific Northwest has been linked to hundreds of deaths in the region over just the past week, with British Columbia alone reporting at least 486 sudden and unexpected fatalities. While it's unclear how many of those deaths were a direct consequence of a heat wave, the chief coroner of the Canadian province said in a statement that it is believed likely that the significant increase in deaths reported is attributable to the extreme weather. In Oregon, the medical examiner's office has received reports of more than 60 deaths, believed to be tied to the dangerously high temperatures that have hit the state in recent days. The temperature in Portland soared to a record 116 degrees Fahrenheit heat that was sufficient to melt city power cables. In the city of Salem, located roughly 50 miles south of Portland, the temperature reached at an all-time high of 117 degrees Fahrenheit. The preliminary cause of death for 45 people in Multnomah County, ranging in age from 44 to 97, was determined to be hyperthermia, an unusually high body temperature caused by a failure of the body to deal with heat, the Wall Street Journal reported recently. By contrast, there were 12 deaths from hyperthermia for all of Oregon between 2017 and 2019, it added. According to the local medical examiner, many of those who died in this county were discovered alone without air conditioning or a fan. Washington State has also experienced record-breaking heat, with two weather stations in Chelan County recording a temperature of 119 degrees Fahrenheit recently. At least 13 people have reportedly died in Seattle area as a result of the heat wave, a number that is likely to grow as high temperatures persist and investigations into recent deaths across the state continue. CNN reported recently that at least 676 people in Washington state visited emergency departments for heat-related symptoms and before the heat wave hit its peak. There were 688 heat-related emergency department visits. Representative Pramila Jayapal, who represents the Seattle area, said recently that the heat wave further demonstrates that climate action is literally a matter of life or death, and it can't wait any longer. Scientists have directly attributed the devastating Pacific Northwest temperature spikes to the human-caused climate crisis, warning that government's continued failure to slash carbon emissions in line with the current science will lead to even more intense heat waves in the near future, with the elderly, the unhoused, the incarcerated people and unprotected outdoor workers among the most vulnerable to such extreme conditions. climate scientist Michael Mann and science communicator Susan Joy Hassell wrote in a New York Times op-ed earlier this week, "We have long known that a warming climate would yield more extremely hot weather. The science is clear on how human-caused climate change is already affecting heat waves. Global warming has caused them to be hotter, larger, longer, and more frequent. What were once very rare events are becoming more common. But there is a way out of this nightmare of ever-worsening weather extremes, and it's one that will serve us well into many other ways, too," they added. "A rapid transition to clean energy can stabilize the climate, improve health, provide good-paying jobs, grow the economy, and ensure children's future. The choice is ours." Dozens of sudden death calls that Vancouver authorities have received recently are believed to be tied to the dangerous heat wave currently scorching Canada and pushing temperatures to record levels. An event expert says a direct result of the human-caused climate emergency. The temperature hit 49.6 degrees Celsius recently in Lytton, British Columbia, an all-time high and the third consecutive day that Canada heat has crushed records. Before this heat wave, the Canadian national heat record stood at 45 degrees Celsius, this record held since July 1937. Meteorologist Scott Duncan noted in a series of tweets, adding, "Along came 27 June and smashed this by a whopping 1.6 degrees Celsius, but we were not done here. The heat wave was just getting started. The very next day, temperatures soared to a staggering 47.9 degrees Celsius, destroying the new record. This did not last long, though." Pointing to the alarming new figures, Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg said that heat records are usually broken by 10th of a degree, not 4.6 degrees Celsius. "We are in a climate emergency that has never once been treated as an emergency," Thunberg added. As the Washington Post reported, the record 121 degrees Fahrenheit temperature in Lytton is more extreme than the all-time high in Las Vegas, 117, and higher than most places in the lower 48 states outside the desert Southwest. "There are temperatures rarely found outside of Death Valley," meteorologist Eric Holthus said of Canada's record heat. "Only a handful of places in the world have ever been this hot."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This is Viewpoints. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, and we want to discuss another important topic regarding the speeches and the addresses of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Brother Ali Alevian, and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali Alevian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaykum assalam. Thank you for having me here.
So today we want to talk about the important concept of adala, or justice, in the thoughts and the speeches of Ayatollah Khamenei. And we know that when founding the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini's main slogan, one of the main slogans, was establishing justice in the society. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, am I true when you are considering all the people the same, you are not observing justice towards them, especially when defined in terms of Islamic, you can't say terminology, Islamic rulings or something like that. Is it true?
That's right. And this is because in musawat or inequality, sometimes we are being unjust. Justice has roots in every single part of life. Even in the family, it is also, you know, about the Muslims, it is said like in Islam, a man is allowed to have four wives. Yeah, it's a verse in the Quran. Yeah. They don't say it's a verse in the Quran.
Yeah, that's right.
That you can have four.
Okay.
You can have one, then two, then three, then four, if you can have justice amongst them. If you can be a just, you know.
If you can establish justice among them.
Yes.
And after that, you cannot.
And then after that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that we know that you cannot. Right. So therefore, you should be.
Get back to the first one. Yeah, one.
Why you cannot do justice? Because when we talk about the justice, this justice should be seen in affection.
That's right.
You know, when you have affection or love with your wives, it should be, you know,
distributed.
Justly.
That's right.
It should be justly. It's not equal. You know, we're not talking about the equality right here. You know, you cannot equally divide the affection or passion or, you know, love between your wives. So when you're having, you know, affairs or any kind of affairs or affection, that should be according to the
justice. In terms of the finance or something, that's right.
In terms of finance, it should be justly.
Okay.
In terms of, I don't know, spending time or having, visiting, it should be justly.
Okay.
So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Allah did not said, if it was equality, that you should see equality amongst your wives, that was very easy to do.
Yes.
You know, it was very easy. I bought a pair of cloth for this one, a pair of cloth for that one. Yeah. But here Allah said, you need to be just, and that is very important. So therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, in every single aspect, we see justice. And wherever there is no justice, that is an oppression.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen. Brother Ali Alavian, the main function of justice or adala in a society has also been emphasized by Rahbar. And according to the Rahbar, this concept of adala or justice has been put in the nature of the creatures and the human beings, the fitrah of human beings, and also the whole system of life. So if you want to follow that naturally, we have to be just toward each other and towards the other. I think this has all, we can say, I find some philosophical tracks in that too, in which that the justice and the concept of adala is in terms of the whole creation of the world and creation of the galaxy. Let's talk a little bit about this. We are so part of a just system. All around us, so we have to act justly, isn't it?
Very true. Basically, it's good to work and actually dive into the meaning of adala and justice first, because before going for asking for adala or justice, if we have no idea of what justice is, then it would be in vain. And also, moreover, I want to emphasize that whatever we are talking about, it does not mean that within the last four decades in the Islamic Republic, there was no trace of justice at all. But to some extent, we are not actually satisfied with whatever has come to people, has come to the nation. And not only in the nation, adala or justice is not going to be confined to a nation or to a group of people, to a class of people, no. Adala is for all the human beings or humankind. And moreover that, or even more, adala is for the whole creatures, as you rightly mentioned, for the whole creatures of God on the scene of the earth. And all the system that we are in actually moves in a justice way. So it can be applied in different ways, different classes of society, different aspects of one's life and all the human beings and all the creatures of God on the scene of the earth.
Just look at how the solar system is acting towards us justly, okay?
As the definition that we started with,
and
to put something in its right place, it's called adala. To give anything its own right, it's called adala. So this can be applied to any part of the world. even, for example, an animal, when it wants to find its own food, so it, the adalah should be actually implemented there as well. So all different parts of the world and the whole creation actually are going to be benefited and to breathe with adalah and justice. So this is something that needs to be clarified, that what we really mean by adalah, because later on that we want to talk about the functions of adalah. When we have no idea of what the definition or what the basis are, then we shall face problems.
That's all right.
So as for adalah or justice, we said that this is a part of our Islamic terminology or Islamic concept that actually is a compulsory or mandatory introduction for the perfection of the human being, or the perfection in general. We have all been created to reach to the perfection, to reach to Kamal.
That's right.
So this is actually, as I said, a compulsory introduction for reaching to that high and great point. And it should be actually looked in different aspects, in the field of economy, in the field of, let's say, politics, in the field of different classes of the society. So it should be regarded and considered exactly that what we mean. For example, a person living in a village or and the person who is living in the capital, they should receive the same rights that they deserve to. But I'm not talking about equal rights that they deserve.
Yeah, because they have different potentials, you know.
Yeah.
But the case is that from the very beginning, when we are making the policies, we have to observe this justice. Because sometimes we are looking at justice as the product and not the process, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So everything happens, and then we are looking for justice. This is not so.
Very true.
In writing the constitution, the laws, in giving different resources to different cities or states of a country, we have to observe justice, and we have to
implement justice. Very true. It should be actually noted, and it should be in the minds of those who are in the field of decision making or in the level of decision making to look at as rightly what you mentioned. But inshallah, well, later on that we are going to have a pathological look at the let's say hindrances and obstacles of adalah. We shall reach to this point, I think, when we want to say that what are the obstacles that we cannot have it, and we just look at adalah as a production.
That's right.
And this is a wrong, let's say, concept towards adalah.
That's right. Sayyid Mohsen, most of the time, this concept of adalah is felt from the time of from the side of government towards the people. Okay, so when we are especially in justice movements that are happening today all across the world for, I don't know, for the colored people, for minorities, for, we can say, the gender-based right movements that are happening, and also sexual ones, you see that they want laws from the from the side of constitution or from the side of the state and the government. But it seems, according to what Rahbar says, this kind of justice or adalah is put inside the fitrah of human being. So you yourself first have to observe it toward yourself and the nature around you, isn't it?
Well, there is a discussion basically that when we look at the society or a country where we need to have justice, yet it is the duty of every single person to observe justice.
That's right.
And it is in the fitrah. But there is another discussion that there must be a person, a leader, who himself observes the justice and who implies justice on the society.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Allah has given us a free will. With our free will, if we leave everyone on their own, they do not deal with the people according to the justice, because they have their own, you know, they have their own personal preferences. And due to those personal preferences, most of the time people do not observe justice. So there must be someone who should basically apply rules and who should make people to observe justice. So yes, on the other hand, it is the duty of every single person. Why? Because in the Quran, even in the Islamic texts, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did not put this duty of observing justice on the rulers only.
That's right.
On the governments only. Allah has, in the Quran, we have verses that are talking about the people. you know, it's about the people. And in that, obviously, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking to the people, Allah has said that, for example, you know, let me just bring up the verse. It's chapter Nisa, verse number 135. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu kunu qawwamina bil qist.
That's right.
Kunu qawwamina bil qist means you are the ones, be the ones who establishes the justice.
That's right.
So that you are the witnesses lillah, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
To Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So basically where Quran is talking about the ruler to be just, to deal with the people at different statuses, as I explained before, like for example for Imam al-Jama'ah, for the ruler, for the judge, for the mujtahid, and there are other places a person needs to observe justice. Allah also has said to the mu'mineen that you should establish justice amongst you, because if you do not establish justice amongst you, then you're answerable, you're accountable on the day of judgment.
And there is a topology given by Rahbar that talks about the concept of justice in different arenas: the religious adala, the personal one, the social one, the political one, the economic one. Okay, these are different topologies that are given by the supreme leader of Iran. I think we have to discuss them one by one.
Yes.
What we do not have time for this session. Let's get to them, inshallah, one by one, upcoming session of the program. For example, what does it mean by economic justice,
very
or
true,
social justice or political justice in terms of the Islamic concept? It was very kind of you, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and Brother Ali Alavian. Thank you very much for your presence in this episode of the program, Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/en. Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
You came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Allah. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي، يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The founding of two North American neighboring countries, Canada and the U.S., has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems, says Siku Alulu, writer, in an article published under the heading, Canada's Indigenous Genocide is Ongoing. Stay tuned for more. The recovery of mass and unmarked graves at former Indian residential school sites in recent weeks has released a deluge of outrage and grief across the settler colony known as Canada. Horrifying truths are being unearthed that reveal the treachery by which Canadian governments, churches, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, originally stole and continue to steal Indigenous lands. We say recoveries because these are not new discoveries. This particular form of genocide unleashed against Indigenous children has been aggressively instituted and actively concealed by Canadian governments, churches, and RCMP since 1831, when the first residential school was established in Brantford, Ontario. Genocide here is defined both as murders of children and criminal acts of negligence and mistreatment that caused deaths that could have been prevented if authorities had acted on the concerns that were repeatedly brought to government. The high death rates, inhospitable conditions, and preventable causes of death were known. It was not secret, even beyond the stories from survivors and all we heard during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, states Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson, referring to a national commission that took place in 2008 in a recent social media post. It was known by the government, known by the churches, and to some degree, known by the Canadian public. We cannot pretend this is a revelation. That would also be hiding the truth. This is a reckoning of generations of criminal wrongdoing and widespread complicity in this brutal system, unquote. None of what we say here is news. Rather, it is the culmination of urgent messages that Indigenous peoples have been shouting for years across the country and the globe in myriad ways, in perpetuity. I find myself frustrated with words at this point. Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott tells people because they so often take the place of action in this country. These are recoveries of people's loved ones who never made it home. The truth that were always suppressed and denied. The anguish that makes sense of their lives and compounded righteous rage. Fitting that the national holidays of Canada Day and Independence Day in the U.S. were preceded by this stark opportunity for citizens to finally say the truth of their countries. The founding of these two North American neighboring countries has everything to do with genocide and erasure of Indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems. James Baldwin described this willful amnesia in the context of slavery and anti-black racism as a sinister crime, rendering white citizens ignorant of both self-knowledge and the systematic violence that they personally reinforce. Genocide and erasure are the origins and continued modes of operation of these countries. clearing the land for white settlement was enacted by police and government officials through the deliberate spread of smallpox in British Columbia, for example. Railroads built by Chinese laborers, many of whom were indentured, forged paths for white settlers through the provinces and shore up the country. Starvation tactics were used in the prairies to thin indigenous populations, weaken resistance, force them onto reserves, and sign treaties in which the rights entitled to the land were officially extinguished. Erasure of indigenous presence through the Indian Act and reserve system, building cities and extractive resource projects over sacred homelands, sterilizing women and kidnapping children are just some examples of how this settler nation was built. After we shake off the emotional petrification and a spiritual shock, we recenter ourselves in understanding that not even horror writers can come up with something as sickening and culturally destructive as the realities the indigenous nations are coming to terms with now. And over recent years since TRC reports were published, Mohawk Tuscarora poet, media producer, and artist Janet Rogers shares these notes. They say, "The truth is more disgusting than fiction, and it was all brought here from over there." Indigenous voices are urgently asserting that colonial genocide and erasure are far from over. Although the schools, or as many are more accurately calling internment camps, officially closed in 1996, we continue to exist within a genocidal society superimposed upon indigenous homelands that targets women and children at unconscionable rates. Canada's aggressive institution of Indigenous youth genocide carries on to this day in the accelerated form of the foster care system that breaks apart Indigenous families and apprehends children at higher rates than residential schools, redistributing them in mostly non-Indigenous families and away from their communities. It also carries on in the federal government's refusal to cease discriminating against and violating the human rights of children by obstructing immediate access to health care and other needed resources, despite direct rulings by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal in 2016 and 19 non-compliance orders issued since then. The institution of genocide persists in the crushing ongoing crisis of Indigenous and especially Inuit youth suicide. If it were to happen in these overwhelming numbers in any non-Indigenous community in Canada, it would be considered an absolute emergency, states Inuk writer and performer Instuk Makri. This is an emergency and it is falling on unwilling hearts, unquote. Genocide persists in the racist Canadian healthcare system that enables widespread negligence and malpractice at the expense of Indigenous lives. It persists in the extinguishment clauses that remain central to modern-day treaties with federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It persists in governments' failure to officially recognize Indigenous languages or ensure access to fresh drinking water or adequate housing. It persists and a rampant systematic racism within the RCMP. This national police force was established in 1873 to suppress Indigenous peoples, forcibly settle and relocate people to reserves and other remote locations, enforce the Indian Act, and of course, kidnap Indigenous children. Genocide persists in the arrest and criminalization of Indigenous land protectors enacting responsibilities to sources of life in the homelands. The historic erasure and fierce protection of institutionalized white crimes against humanity is finally coming to light. The callous failure to notify thousands of indigenous families of these deaths. Mass destruction of records. Continual withholding of records. Refusal to disclose names of perpetrators. The obstruction of any accountability or justice. Colonizers bury the truth of their horrific crimes with the bodies of the precious children in this land in mass grave sites that were never meant to be found without gravestones, without ceremony, humanity, or remorse. At least in the earth, they could be held and in some way returned to creation. The deliberate effort to make these mass grave sites appear invisible, like an ordinary open field, is a perfect example of Canadian nationalism. Institutionalized racism and white supremacy have been so extensively normalized as to be invisible and even trivial to most Canadians. The ongoing violence and, yes, genocide that make way for Canadian authorities and non-Indigenous society to thrive are characteristically hidden, suppressed, denied, and simply ignored. Erasure of the truth is a practice of genocide, refusing to admit actual genocide by downplaying actions that the state not only instigated but continues to protect is a practice of genocide. These systems are in need of profound scrutiny and destabilization, as absence of remorse or accountability breeds only further promise of harm. As the Canadian government, RCMP, and churches abdicate responsibility and place the onus on each other to apologize, Indigenous voices are demanding that all of them, as well as the predators and murderers in official positions at these schools, be held to account for their crimes against humanity.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.